Good evening. I am dedicating this broadcast to Captain Levi Jackson of Martha's Vineyard and the brave fishermen who went with him to the wreck of the six-masted schooner Murty B. Crowley that grounded on the shoals of Edgartown in January 1910. By superhuman strength and skill, Captain Levi and his crew made one of the most spectacular and successful rescues ever attempted, for which they received the coveted Carnegie Medal for heroism at sea. A few weeks ago, I told you about Captain John Crowley and the five, six, and seven-masted schooners that he created. The Murty B, as she was affectionately called, was launched from the Cobb Butler Shipyard in Rockland, Maine, just 38 years ago today. And as a kid of 13 summers, I was on hand with my Brownie camera to photograph the event. I sold enough postcards of that launching to pay for a new pair of shoes that I needed for the opening term of school. On August 24th, 1907, at 11:45 noon, Mrs. Crowley herself, gorgeous in a white serge suit and a big hat with yellow plumes and roses, smashed a bottle of champagne over the boat, which was named for her. A few days later, the proud six-master sailed for Philadelphia to take on her first cargo of coal, 5,000 tons. Her skipper on the maiden voyage was Captain E.W. Babbitt, but at the time of the wreck, she was in command of Captain William Haskell of Deer Isle, and it's always been a mystery how such a capable captain should have been so completely fooled by fog that he didn't recognize old, familiar, friendly lighthouses when he saw them. The time was January 1910, and the Murty B, now 3 years old, was loading coal in Philadelphia for Portland, Maine. A terrific nor'east storm had lashed the Atlantic coast for over a week, and when the six-master sailed and got out into deep water, she was soon wallowing in heavy winter swells. It had cleared off cold with a fresh wind, and there was nothing to indicate that this would be anything but a routine trip. However, the weather around New England can be freakish and fickle, as you all know, and all of a sudden a fog rolled in that blotted out everything. It came fast, it was pea soup thick, and it stayed. Just before midnight, the mercury dropped, and instantly, line and chain and mast and sail were covered with glare ice. There they were, wallowing around in the dark and fog, with those six big booms swaying like pendulums every time she rolled. When they fetched up on the taut ropes and the six sails slatted like cannon fire, a ton of tua ice in the shape of glass slivers rained down on the slippery deck. Captain Haskell posted lookouts, but it was no use. They couldn't see a boat length ahead or astern. It was the coldest, longest, thickest fog he'd ever encountered. And without steerage way, he could only guess the extent of the vessel's drift in the strong current, and he guessed wrong. Once when the fog lifted for an instant and he saw a light, he said, "If that's Shinnecock light, and I think it is, we ought to make Block Island Bemannin and go through the sound." But it was Block Island he'd seen and passed. They were 40 miles off their course, and the fog had closed in again. Later, when it lifted a bit, Captain Haskell ordered the sheets flattened, and sailing close-hauled on the port tack, he stood in toward the mainland, looking for some familiar landmark or harbor. For 30 long, cold, weary, nerve-wracking hours, he stayed on deck, straining eyes and ears for some sight or sound that would lead to safety. There was nothing but cold, black silence and freezing fog. On through the night they drifted, still believing that Block Island lay ahead. And when dawn did come and the mist cleared and the lookout saw a light ahead, Captain Haskell heaved a sigh of relief and went below for a mug-up. "Good old Block Island," he smiled. "Now we know where we are." But he was awfully mistaken. They had sailed south of the vineyard all night, and the light they were approaching was Edgartown Harbor Light, shining above the low sand dunes along the south shore of the vineyard where the sand drips and the shoals run out for miles into the sea. Still unaware of the danger just ahead, the great schooner sailed serenely on, then with no warning whatever, ran head-on into the sandbars. Deprived of water under her 300-foot-long keel, the magnificent Murty B. Crowley was instantly doomed. The first big breaker that boiled over her sturdy deck swept everything overboard. The second wave crushed the after-deck cabin and smashed the lifeboats to kindling. The third wave poured down the hatches, flooding the forecastle. The speed and weight and power of such waves is incredible to the landsman. Unless you've seen a midwinter nor'east storm slashing the New England coast with all its force and fury, you have no idea how quickly a ship can be destroyed. In Winthrop and along the boulevards of Lynn and Revere, I've seen 2-ton blocks of granite hurled about like chips, while whole sections of the highway were ripped up, along with good-sized buildings, and smashed by a single wave into oblivion. Such were the waves that pounded the Murty B the moment she struck the sandbar. Realizing they didn't have one chance in 10 million of being saved from those shoals and the raging surf, Captain Haskell gave orders for the crew to climb into the forward rigging and stay there. Then he remembered his wife, sleeping soundly in their luxurious cabin. As there'd been no gale or storm, Mrs. Haskell had passed the night, peacefully unaware of any danger, till the first big breaker smote the deck above her and water poured under the door. Then she heard her husband, "Get out of there, quick as you can. Here, put on this coat. No, we haven't time to save anything." He helped her pull the pea jacket over her thin nightgown, then pushed her barefoot up the ice-covered companionway to the deck. "Into the ratlins, quick," he shouted, as a great wall of water, taller than their house at home, rolled toward the schooner. They made it, but they were drenched from head to foot, and in the below-zero temperature, the woman's scant clothing froze solid. "You've got to get up higher. Here comes another one." But Mrs. Haskell stood stock still on her numbed and bleeding feet. "I can't make it, Bill," she gasped. "I can't make it. I can't go any higher." Two sailors crawling over the forerigging and reached her just as her knees buckled. And with the captain's help, they lifted and hauled her higher and higher till finally she was in the cross trees far above the deck. From some dim spot way off in the distance, she heard her husband, "Hang on, hang on tight and don't look down." And then she felt a wet rope around her waist as he lashed her tight against the swinging, swaying mast. "If she faints or freezes, at least she won't fall," he said. "Not unless the mast go." Wiping the spray from his bloodshot eyes, he looked out through the ice-encased rigging over the cold gray sea. There wasn't a sail or a sign of smoke anywhere. He felt drowsy and weak, but he shook himself awake, and with the last ounce of strength left, he passed the rope around his own waist and bent it fast. From far down below him, there came the dull, wrenching groan of parting timbers and steel. Then the sharp, sickening crack of a giant mast. Another wave and another mast fell to the deck. Another wave and the giant schooner split in two. The big, beautiful, six-masted Murphy B. Crowley that I saw launched 38 years ago today was going down with 15 freezing people hanging in her rigging. I've heard several versions of this shipwreck, but the most accurate and vivid account comes from the pen of Phillips N. Case, president of the Blair Manufacturing Company in Springfield. Mr. Case has kindly sent me a copy of his story, To the Rescue, which was copyrighted and published in 1940. On the morning of the wreck, he said, a group of Edgartown citizens saw the big master dragging toward the shore. When they saw she was going to hit, they turned, and as if with a single impulse, they turned toward the home of the one man on Martha's Vineyard who could and would attempt to rescue the crew. That man was Captain Levi Jackson, known the world over, they say, for his unflinching courage and utter disregard of personal safety. His exploits had won for him the local nickname of Ready to Die Jackson, but the youngsters who worshipped him as their hero shortened the title to Ride-Di-Di-Die Jackson, and so to old Ride-Di-Di's the Edgartown men went and banged on his kitchen door. When Levi heard them pounding so urgently, he knew what it meant. Another shipwreck. He jumped out of bed and into his red flannels. Boots, oilskins, and sou'wester came next. A quick gulp of coffee, a nod to his wife, and Levi was ready as he'd been so many times before. His face was grave when he shut the door, but all he said to the fisherman was, "All right, let's go." Down at the wharf, his crew already had the engine of his fishing smack to Priscilla warming up, and it didn't take Levi two shakes of a lamb's tail to hoist the jib and mainsail and cast off the fore and aft lines. To the crowd on the wharf, he raised a brushed goodbye as though he were just going after a mess of mackerel. Straight for Cape Pogue he steered, and after an hour of battling the heavy swells, they rounded the point and headed down the shore toward the squalls and the wreck of the Murphy B. Crowley. The revenue cutter Acushnet had arrived under forced draft, but she had to lay to a mile offshore on account of shoal water. No lifeboat was launched because the skipper believed it couldn't live in such a sea, and he said he'd only be sacrificing his men. What if he did get everybody off the Crowley and then they all capsized? Captain Levi Jackson was thinking the same thing. But he kept right on going. The water was far too rough for his small boat to venture into the main channel between Skiff's Island and Muskeget, so he worked along through shallow water between the island and the point. He watched his chance to scoot between two towering big seas and then let her rip and got out into deep water where he wanted to be. Now his main worry was the big breakers which rose without warning all around him and came crashing down from every direction. The whole shoal was a seething cauldron, so his only chance of reaching the wreck was to watch for a long rolling breaker, run ahead of it just right, and let it carry him straight to the stranded ship. That sort of thing takes guts and skill and luck. Levi finally worked the Priscilla around till she was a quarter of a mile from the Crowley, and the break came, and he began the dash, but he saw another huge wave coming in the opposite direction, so he came about fast and tried it over again. That time he down near tipped over. A big sea flooded the entire cockpit and knocked him flat. He yelled, "Bail, you sons of guns, bail, or we'll all drown." And bail those fishermen did. The third time he hit the wave fair and square, and it carried him smack over the shoal, but beyond the wreck. So he yanked the wheel hard over and thus came alongside the half-sunken stern and dropped his two anchors. The crawler had broken in two, and between the bow and the stern sections was a narrow strip of water less turbulent than the rest. "Now, fellows," Captain Levi said, "let's see if we can get them people out of the rigging. I want four of you men to put your dories over and row straight for the wreck. When you get under one of them folks, yell for them to jump and try to catch them, but keep rowing. Don't tie up alongside or you'll be crushed like an eggshell. Keep clear of the gear and the wreckage and get back here as fast as you can. Now get going, boys, and good luck." True to the traditions of the sea, Mrs. Haskell was rescued first. With her husband's help, she climbed painfully down from the crosstrees to a spot in the rigging just above the sweep of the highest wave. She knew when the time came for her to jump, there'd be no one to help it. She'd have to gauge the distance, throw herself into midair, and trust to the skill of the men in the dories that now looked like little peapods so far, far below. The white-faced men in the four boats clustered together in the deep, dark trough of the sea, waited for a big swell that would carry them up close to the submerged shroud. When it came and they rose on the foaming crest of the breakers, they all yelled, "Jump!" Without an instant's hesitation, the half-frozen, ice-clad woman leaped and landed in the bottom of the second dory and fainted dead. In no time, they had her aboard the Priscilla, where Captain Levi was waiting with hot coffee and blankets. One by one, the 15 survivors jumped from the rigging of the wreck, and only the steward fell overboard. But he was rescued, and the little 40-foot fishing boat, with 21 passengers and crew, started back through the boiling surf toward Edgartown. Only Captain Levi Jackson and his men will ever know what a dangerous trip that was. 7 times they nearly capsized. 3 they were almost swamped. But they finally made the wharf, and the whole town was there to greet them. A few months later, Captain Levi and his courageous comrades were given Carnegie medals for unusual heroism at sea. And if I'm not mistaken, the little Priscilla was taken to Nantucket and made into a tea room. Well, if you are listening, Captain Levi, here's to your good health, long life, smooth seas, and a fair wind to you, and all the brave Yankee skippers on Martha's Vineyard.